Welcome to Sausage on a Fork, a podcast dedicated to the UK's longest-running children's drama programme, Grange Hill. My name's Neil, and in each episode, I'll interview a former cast member about their life before, during, and after their time on the programme. Okay, welcome to the latest episode of Sausage on a Fork, and it is a first for Sausage on a Fork because we've got someone who played a parent. We've never had anyone before who played a parent in Grange Hill, and I have been joined by none other than David Sharl, who played Tom Hargreaves, Spencer Hargreaves' dad. David, welcome to Sausage on a Fork.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Brilliant, brilliant. So what we'll do, David, now, and the very first question I normally ask is, how did you get into acting? But that's not the first question I'm going to ask, because when I was doing research on you, the research said that you were not actually born in England. Is this correct?
This is correct, yeah. My dad was American.
Right.
And was in the American Air Force. Uh-huh. So he was stationed in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Wow, right.
And when I came along, and that's where I was born.
Right.
And home of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, yeah. And so did you live over there for long, like?
Yeah, well, one of my earliest memories of America is a hurricane that we all went through in 1969.
Wow.
And it's still the second most powerful hurricane in American history, second only to Katrina.
Wow.
And it's called Hurricane Camille. And we were actually living in a trailer park at the time. And all the airmen in the Air Force were ordered to go to these like cube-shaped hurricane shelters.
Uh-huh.
So we had to go and stay in one of those shelters, whereas some people elected to stay in the trailer park. And then when we came back, just about every single trailer was blown over, except I think for ours and one other. But a tree had broken in half and dented my bedroom in the trailer park. But it was extraordinary because I still remember walking around Biloxi in Mississippi and looking at the devastation.
Yeah.
One of my main memories is this amusement park being completely obliterated that had only just opened. And on the beach was laying a dead cow.
Wow.
So, yeah, it must have got swept.
Yeah, it was definitely, definitely. So then, so at what age were you then when you moved over to England then?
Well, I believe I was 7, but we'd already been to Germany.
Uh-huh.
And I think maybe we'd come back to England to stay with relatives for a few months as well.
Uh-huh.
But we came back to England properly in 1970.
Right.
And we moved to Stevenage in Hertfordshire.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. So now we will ask the question that I always ask at the beginning. So how did you get into acting?
Well, it's a bit of a strange story, actually, Neil, because what happened was I was sort of going nowhere fast, you know.
Right.
I think a lot of people who've been to new schools really struggle with this. You know, my ability to learn wasn't fantastic at that age because I was shunted from American schools to German schools to English schools. I was very sort of unsettled and anxious from all the moving around. So I left school at 16, did a couple of jobs, and then eventually went on to a skills centre in Letchworth. I wasn't very good at that. I got kicked off that. So the guy at the skills centre said to me, I was on a bricklaying course, then I was on a woodwork course. And the guy on the woodwork course said to me, you got two left hands, haven't you? And I was like, yeah. And he said, well, look, he said, I didn't find this. It found me. So you have to pursue what you're good at and something will find you. So the only thing I was any good at was English.
Right.
Despite leaving school, I think I left school with 2 O-levels. And that was like maths and English. So if you're going to leave with 2 O-levels, those are the ones to have. So I went to Stevenage College, started studying A-levels. And we did a play in the A-levels called The Caretaker by Harold Pinter.
Uh-huh.
So we had to watch the production of it, which was on video. So I watched it by myself, and it was this production containing Jonathan Pryce, Warren Mitchell, and Kenneth Cranham. And Jonathan Pryce was playing Mick in The Caretaker. So I sat there watching this video and just this little light went on and I was like, oh my God, that's what I want to do for a living.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems completely bonkers. You know, at this stage, I was about 19.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I'd even been to see a play, you know, and then from that moment, I started pursuing acting. So I did, I joined the local Amdram Society and the North Arts Youth Theatre. And we did A View from the Bridge by Harold Pinter. And the local paper awarded me the Actor of the Year award.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, I'm really good at this. I must be the new Marlon Brando. So I started auditioning to drama schools. There was a guy called John Gardner who was a very, talented guy who really should have been in the profession, I think. But he ran the Queen Mother Theatre in Hitchin. And he helped me with my audition speech. And it turned out he'd actually been to Rose Bruford. So I was like, okay, I'd like to audition for Rose Bruford myself. Because at the time, it was the only drama school that did a degree.
Right.
And if you couldn't get a degree, then the funding that you would get, remember funding? Probably not. Because no one gets it now. But the funding you would get would be discretionary. So you had to then go and audition in front of the local council, you know. I thought, wow. I want to avoid that all costs. So because it was a degree, it was mandatory grant.
Right.
So I got into Rose Bruford and I was so lucky. I got a full grant. You know, during the holidays, you could claim housing benefit.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a great time to go to drama school. It was in the 80s. We had a family tragedy before I went.
Right.
In 1985, one of my brothers had died.
Right.
He was only 17, bless him. Uh-huh. But he had a very mild form of epilepsy, and then
right.
he died from he had his first grand mal seizure mm-hmm. in the shower. But I mentioned that because it was on my mind.
Yeah.
When I went to drama school, so the first year was a bit of a blur.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, I sort of was getting used to it. I wasn't very happy in the first year. The head of acting didn't like me.
Right.
He kept telling me I was a very limited actor. And then the last couple of years, I was having a better time. But I did find drama school very, very difficult. You know?
Right. Yeah.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
So that's how it happened. And then I left drama school in 88 and, you know, and struggled basically. Right.
Okay, so when you were at drama school, was there anyone else there with you who we might know?
Well, someone who'd left was Gary Oldman.
All right.
He'd left a few years before me, and you know, he's gone on to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
There was a guy called Brian McCarty who was a couple of years above me, who was in the film Speed 2.
Right.
Which was the one that bombed.
Right.
But he's gone on to have a pretty good career.
Uh-huh.
There's a woman called Emma Ray who's in the Liverpool series.
Watching. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she went there. And then in later years, Stephen Graham was there.
Right.
Another actor called Joseph Milson, I believe, went there. Uh-huh. So, you know, Rose Bruford has produced some really good actors.
Yeah.
Tom Baker went there, you know, Doctor Who.
Yeah.
We're not quite as starry as Rada, say, but you know, we increasingly have people who go on to do well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then you left in 88, you just said there. I went up and looking through your career and your CV. The first thing that's listed for you was London's Burning in 1992. Now, I mean, that was a massive program, wasn't it? I don't think people realize how big that program actually
was. No, they used to get like 20 million viewers. I've got a really good friend called Steve North who played Colin in London's Burning. And the first time I did London's Burning, my scene got cut out. But I met a girl there called Louise Middleton, who I subsequently started going out with.
Uh-huh.
And she was friends. Her family were friends with the director, John Reardon. So I actually got that scene that is now listed through sheer nepotism.
Right, okay.
I went to dinner, you know, with John Reardon at my then girlfriend's home.
Yeah.
And he said, oh yeah, you did London's Burning before, didn't you? I said, yeah, it got cut out. And he said, "Oh well, we better get you back in it then."
Fair play.
And then I went back in it, and I was in a scene. I don't think Steve was in it, but Ross Boatman was in it. Glenn Murphy, you know, and a lot of the regulars. Andrew Casamayor was in it. And I remember we were doing this long tracking shot through a shopping centre. And it was then I realised I had no idea what I was doing on TV because I spent 3 years at drama school and it was all geared towards theatre work.
Yeah.
So the minute I have to start walking and talking, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And the guy playing, you know, Andrew Casamayor, who played one of the main guys in it, said, "Look, just take your lead from me. I'll show you." But I was terrible. I remember being scared of the camera. So I wasn't very good to start with.
Had you done theatre work before then?
Yeah, I'd done, right. I'd done a lot of pub theatre in London. And I had actually, I did do a TV job before that on The Bill. I literally had two lines on it.
Right.
But London's Burning was my first proper acting job.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and I learned a lot, but I just remember thinking I was terrible. I was awful. I can't act. But I just had never been trained for TV. So I didn't know what I was doing.
Okay. And then, so there was a few other things. Like I was looked like ID, the football hooligan thing, Our Friends in the North and stuff. And I hope you don't take offence when I've written this this one here, because I've written down that a lot of your roles were like either end of the spectrum, weren't they? You were either like a thug or a policeman or a prison officer and stuff. And I just think two polar opposites there. And
What are you trying to say, mate? Look at me. I look like a thug. You know what I mean? ID. I was cast as this character called Paul Funnel.
Yeah.
Who had strangled someone with a Union Jack.
Right, okay.
Before that, I did a film with Michael Winner. Uh-huh. And I basically got shouted at for about 3 hours.
It was Dirty Weekend.
So I did that before ID. And I was so traumatized coming off the back of ID. Coming off the back of Dirty Weekend, that when I did ID, I said to Phil Davis, who directed it, I said, "I just did Dirty Weekend with Michael Winner, and he spent 3 hours shouting at me." And he went, and Phil Davies went, "Well, that's no good, is it?" He said, "We won't shout at you." And I spoke to Sean Pertwee, who was also in both films, and he said whenever Michael Winner gave him a note, he would just look at him and go, "Yeah, yeah, you want me to do it like that, do you?" So, yeah, it was an interesting... an interesting baptism, but ID was fantastic.
Yeah.
That made me feel like an actor. I don't know how long, I can't remember how long the shoot was, 12 weeks maybe.
Right.
But we went up to Sheffield and Rotherham and Bradford, you know, and I was working with great actors like Warren Clark, Saskia Reeves, Reece Dinsdale, a good mate of mine now called Nick Bartlett, you know.
Yeah.
And I had a great time doing that film.
Brilliant. And so, like I just said, you're either a cast as a thug or a police officer, which brings us on to, is it the murder of Stephen Lawrence?
Yeah.
When you and you played D.S. Bevan in that. Now, you know, based on the true story, when you're filming something like that, is the atmosphere on set different to what it would be normally, because of the story that you're trying to tell?
Yeah, and that is a brilliant question, because the answer is yes, it was different.
Right.
And I'll tell you exactly how it's different. So that film was directed by Paul Greengrass, who has subsequently gone on to direct some of the Bourne movies.
All right.
I mean, he's like a big Hollywood director now. He did a film about 9/11 called United.
Oh, yeah.
Something or other. I can't remember what it's called now. Yeah. And he specializes in these like apparently drama documentaries. They're actually dramas, but they look like documentaries. Right. And he did one about Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland to great critical acclaim. So in The Murder of Stephen Lawrence, I was working with Marianne Jean-Baptiste, Hugh Quashie, and some other fantastic actors who I didn't know before. And because they were all playing the Lawrence family, when myself and Jenny, who was playing the other family liaison officer, when we came in the house, it was like, you could hear a pin drop,
right.
You know, you could cut the atmosphere with a knife, because it was like We were really these horrible coppers.
Yeah.
And Marianne Jean-Baptiste was so brilliant as Doreen. I was getting quite choked up as well. So Paul, you know, told me that D.S. Bevan was based on this real guy. So I didn't want to make him a real demon, but
yeah,
apparently, according to the information Paul Greengrass had, the police planted evidence and things nice. Like that. And they also suggested that Stephen Lawrence was in a gang. So, you know, we produced these gloves and these plastic bags and we go, you know, did this belong to Stephen? And his dad, you know, played by Hugh, goes, well, what are you trying to get us to say that he was a burglar?
Yeah.
And he said, our son was a good boy and he wasn't in any gangs or anything like that.
Yeah.
Now, I've subsequently heard a lot of conflicting reports about Stephen Lawrence, none of which I believe.
Right.
But I've been told by some people that he was a drug dealer, you know, these guys knew him. There was actually six of them, it turns out.
Right.
There was another guy that never got prosecuted. But my perspective of that case has always been from the film that we did, because Paul Greengrass researched it extensively, yeah. You know, and I really trust his opinion and also, or his research, I should say, not his yeah. opinion. And yeah. also, you know, the police were proven to be institutionally racist at that time. And, it, you know, that case changed the whole culture of British policing.
Yeah.
So it was a really important film. And I've never done a job before where people have rung me up and gone, that was one of the most harrowing, brilliant films I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, and Neil yeah. Maskell was in it, David Corder, you know, some of my acting idols.
Uh-huh.
Film. So I feel very lucky to have done that.
Brilliant, brilliant. Okay, so then moving on then. So that was, well, that went out in 1999, that film. So then the next year was when we first saw you in Grange Hill. So how did that come about?
So, I mean, I think I just got an audition for it. So around the time I did Our Friends in the North, I actually went back to Central School of Speech and Drama
right.
to do a one-year teaching course, because my then girlfriend said to me, you know, if acting doesn't pan out, you need something to fall back on. And she was quite right. So I went back to, I went to Central and did a teaching course.
Right.
And during that year that I did the teaching course, I got cast in Our Friends in the North. And I think the Grange Hill thing happened around that time as well.
Right.
But I just remember going to the BBC for an audition and being told, you know, it's just a normal audition. I was called into an office and I think there was like two or three people there, you know, the casting director and maybe a couple of producers as well. You'll appreciate it's a bit hazy. But I do remember doing very well in the audition and then being pleased with the character and then, you know, go home and then you get the fantastic call from the agent saying that you got the part.
Brilliant.
So.
So obviously when you joined Grange Hill, you were obviously like a bit older than sort of like the core audience would have been. But when you were, Grange Hill started when you were about 15, 16, I think it was 1978. So were you aware of the program?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was famous. You know, Todd Carty, who played Tucker, was in it.
Yeah.
You know, there are lots of other characters who everybody knew.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember their names now. It's such a long time. But
there
was a spin-off series as well called Tucker's Luck, which Todd Carty was in. So it was a very prominent, you know, kids' TV show back in the day. And Ben Elton used to make jokes about it.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, sir. We're the only kids in the UK. Don't say.
Yeah.
You know, so it was all that, you know, everybody used to talk about it at school and go, oh, did you see, you know, what was Susan Tully's name in it? I can't remember now.
Suzanne Ross, her name was.
Anne Ross, yeah.
Suzanne, yeah.
And who was the main bad kid at the school round about that time?
So there was a few. So when Tucker was there, it was Booger Benson. But then a couple of years later, was Gripper.
Gripper Stebson.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the one I remember.
Yeah.
Flipper
right.
and feeling
Okay.
feeling a little bit scared of him, you know.
Yeah, but on that, because so Gripper Stevenson, was obviously left by the time you were there, but he'd been involved in sort of like a big racist storyline.
Yeah.
The very first scene where you were in, we don't get that from you at all. Obviously, you're there trying to get Spencer out of bed, and he sort of ends up. We do get a sense that maybe Tom Hargreaves' temper was quite short, and because he ends up getting into an argument with Spencer and storming out and slamming the bedroom door. And then Spencer's at school and he's shown some like just slight racist tendencies. You know, he talked about, there was a thing with like they're in a cookery lesson and he's talking about how whatever they make, it should be British food, you know, and things like that. And then he says to one of the teachers that his dad had told him that although like it was a history lesson, and I think they were doing about the British Empire, and he said that although the British had taken natural resources from the countries that they'd invaded, he'd helped them to read because all the people in those countries were all thick. And you think, hang on, his dad's telling them that, like, and then it just gives us a little bit of an insight into what Spencer's dad was like. And then there's then a scene then at Spencer's house, because it becomes quite clear what Spencer's dad is like, where he's there making racist jokes and stuff like that. And when you think about that, just having that on a kids' TV program was unheard of as well. All right, we'd had the stuff with Gripper before, but then to just have like a parent doing those sorts of things, and you just think that's pretty near the knuckle for a kids' TV to be doing that. But then it then becomes, we then get sort of like the main crux of your storyline then, and what Tom Hargreaves was all about, because he'd been out to the pub to watch the football. I think it was England that had been playing.
Yeah.
And obviously he gets drunk and he's walking home and he's singing Land of Hope and Glory. And a fella who's walking past him joins in. But the fella who joins in with him is a black man. And then Tom starts having a go at him, then saying, you know, what are you? You shouldn't be singing that. You've got no right and all that. And then...
My memory was he was South Asian.
Right, okay. Okay.
I think, yeah.
So then from that...
I might be wrong about that, but right, it was a long time ago. Okay. But that was my memory.
So from that then, Tom just hits him.
Yeah.
From nothing, really. I mean, the guy doesn't... It's one of them where there's not even like any sort of provocation or anything. And the man's knocked out cold. And we see Tom trying to revive him, get him up. Then Tom just runs. But unbeknownst to Tom, his son, Spencer, has seen it all. Now, when you're doing a scene like that, again, does the atmosphere change?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were all aware of the weight of the storyline.
Uh-huh.
And like a typical actor, I remember... My main concern at the time was doing decent drunk acting.
Right, okay.
You know, that was the only thing I was really... I didn't care about playing a horrible character.
Yeah.
I just wanted... I mean, this is a typical actor thing. I just wanted to make sure that I got the, you know, I got the drunk and acting right. Too much. Which I look back on it now and it was pretty good.
Yeah. You know?
But the thing is, you know, I was a young, ambitious actor, youngish, in my 30s. Uh-huh. I was very ambitious. This, for me, was a plum part.
Yeah.
You know, albeit on a kids' TV show. And, you know, you can be a bit sniffy about kids' TV shows because you think, oh, I'm at Elstree, I want to be doing EastEnders.
Yeah.
Which I have subsequently done. But, you know, after spending best part of a year doing that show, I felt so lucky.
Yeah.
And... You know, and the way that I look, I think, was partly the reason why I got that job, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a big West Ham supporter and, you know, a lot of people at West Ham sort of identify me with the in-betweeners and Jay's dad.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I'm nothing like...
Right, okay.
Even though on my mum's side, they are all from Essex.
Right.
I'm actually, you know, very left-wing and very, you know, in my punk rock days, I used to go on... You know, rock against racism marches, and You know, I remember shouting at the National Front in Stevenage, Nazi scum off the street, and being threatened to be murdered by several skinheads. So I just want to say that I'm a long time anti-fascist activist from years ago.
So is it difficult then playing that part, knowing your own beliefs?
It was very difficult, but I thought it was a really important storyline. You know, racism is not gone away. It probably never will go away.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's so great to see at football people still taking the knee, despite the booing, you know, that you often get. People still take the knee. And I think, you know, there's much more awareness of it.
Yeah.
The police now investigate, you know, hate crime and racially aggravated incidents. And so it's really, really good. We're in a much more aware place. But it's still completely relevant. If you were to do that storyline today, it would still be completely and utterly relevant.
Yeah, definitely. Because as we said, you know, it was the first time where I can remember sort of a parent actually having like a proper story. We heard things about parents where they were ill or where they died, but we didn't always see them. Yeah. So to have that one where a parent was actually dealing with something that wasn't an illness or something like that was very different. And it was all then about the man had gone into intensive care, and it was some of the kids in the school had heard about it, and some of the kids knew him as well. So it was all about Spencer then dealing with it, as well as Mr. and Mrs. Hargreaves dealing with it as well. And the police came and just asked if they knew anything about it. And then Tom took off for a bit, didn't he?
Yeah.
And got out, went away to up north, Scotland, I think was the story.
Yeah.
But Spencer and his mum were then talking about things. Now, when you had a storyline like that, are you aware of all the other bits that are going on in that storyline? Or is it just a case of you doing your own sort of bits?
Well, I'm aware. I would have been aware of what was going on in the show at the time, because I would read the whole script. I wouldn't just read my scenes.
Uh-huh.
But although, when you're doing a lot of different scenes in one day, it is hard to read the whole script.
Yeah.
But back in those days, I did still read the whole script because I wanted to make a good impression and I wanted to know what was going on. So I'm the kind of actor that would read as much as I could beforehand.
Uh-huh.
But I sort of based the character on, you know, some people I knew. I can't remember exactly where, you know, but that sort of racist channeling of fury and when mixed with alcohol, you know, the sort of the sudden violence that can erupt. So I knew this character very well, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I'd grown up in the punk rock scene, for God's sake. And
there was a whole
faction of skinheads and punks that were supporting these pro-England bands, you know, like Cocksparrow and Screwdriver and, you know, all of these, you know, bordering on fascist bands.
Yeah.
So I'd seen a lot of what these kind of people were like and how they were as they got older.
Yeah.
Where the attitudes still stick.
Oh, definitely.
Even though they get a bit quieter about it as they get older.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that was the thing. Like, Spencer had that attitude still. Even though he'd seen what his dad had done, he knew what his dad had done, he was still picking on Anika, the Asian girl.
That's right.
And Miss Carver asked him why, and he said, well, my dad said she shouldn't be here. The immigrants shouldn't be here. And she was like, well, she was born in Britain. And then Miss Carver actually says to him that man was attacked because of people who think the same way that you're speaking.
Mm.
And then you sort of see Spencer sort of starts maybe thinking, what he thought, was that the right thing? Basically, he starts having a sort of like a little crisis of conscience. And as we've said there about Spencer's dad went away, and then the mum went up with the dad as well. And the storyline changed a little bit then to sort of like a bit of like child neglect, because Spencer was left on his own. Spencer's attitude does change then, because the likes of Calvin, who was the black lad, and Anika help him out and start looking after him and stuff
I think in life in general, it's very difficult if your parents are bad role models.
Yeah.
You know, because you're inevitably going to grow up influenced by them.
Yeah.
So I think the catharsis of the storyline was the fact that my son shames me into admitting that what I did wrong.
Well,
And then I then go and hand myself.
Yeah, because that was it. Like, where eventually Spencer's dad came back, and Spencer had his mates around with the mum.
Yeah.
And the dad kicked them out and kicked off and was saying, you know, why are they all around? I'm not going to use any of the language that he uses because I find it hard to use it anyway. But the mum said that, you know, she used to think like the dad, but, you know, obviously her attitude had changed, Spencer's attitude had changed. And there was a bit where, because Spencer's dad was still on the run. He was hiding in the house. He was, I kept the curtains drawn, but he still treated Spencer like a skivvy as well, yeah. You know, making sure, you know, where's me tea and all this. So I have to mention this because I love this bit. There's a bit where they were doing fundraisers in the school, and Spencer and his mates were doing a guess the substance competition. So they had a jar with all sorts of, like, someone said there was old mashed potato in there, and there was like mold, fairy mold, and all sorts in there. And Tom had said, Spencer, make me a cup of tea. So Spencer had this jar. He made the cup of tea and just gave it a little bit of extra flavouring with the jar as well. I'm guessing it was just a normal cup of tea, and they did that.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. What was the substance that he put in? I can't.
Well, there was all sorts in there. There was, as I say, mashed potato, mold. There was all kinds in there. Like, and then Tom's racism was always sort of behind closed doors. But then there was a scene when Anita's mum went to speak to Tom, because she was wondering if Anita was in the house, and Tom sort of says, well, he wouldn't let it in. He doesn't actually say those words, but because the mum says, well, she's been spending a lot of time with your son, and Tom, like, finds that really hard to believe that his son was friends with an Asian girl. And then, but in that conversation that they have, it's quite good because they both were prejudiced, and we get to see that, and I think that's really good for the audience to see that, yes, Tom had his prejudices against people that weren't white, but Mrs. Modi had their prejudice against people that were white as well. Yeah. And I think that's really good to show that for the kids to see that it's not just white people who have racist beliefs or
Racism is endemic in, you know, probably every culture has its own form of racism.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not conspicuous just to, you know, our culture. So I think it's a very important point that.
Yeah, definitely. So then there's all other bits go on there where Tom then has a rant about later on about Anika's mum being there and the fact that whoever Spencer was being friends with, and it's the mum that starts saying stuff. Well, look, the kids that Spencer doesn't see colour. He sees people for who they are, not what they are, type thing. And Tom again says, well, he shouldn't be over here. And that's when Spencer shouts at him, you're wrong, Dad. And it's the first time we really see Spencer standing up to his dad, because he's obviously standing up for what he thinks is right, or what he knows is right, I should say. And then there's a bit where Spencer gets into a fight in school, and he tells his mum and dad that he'd got into this fight with some older lads. And his dad is really pleased with him, like, you know, a good lad and all that. But when Spencer tells him, oh yeah, I was defending Anika and Calvin, that's when his dad's sort of face changed again. Like, and then Spencer comes out with the thing about all bullies are cowards, but he glares at his dad when he says that. And then obviously then the police turn up saying about the fact that he had a description of the man who'd been seen, and you know, Tom fitted it. Tom gave this false alibi. The mum wouldn't say, she couldn't remember if he'd been in the house or not that night. And then Spencer, even though he'd seen it, didn't give his dad up, but told him later on that he'd seen him attack the man, and that he'd lied for him because he was still scared of his dad. But he wasn't going to be scared anymore, and that he hated his dad. And then the next time we see the dad, he tells Spencer that he's going to hand himself in, which again, which was obviously really important to the story. The fact that Tom decided to do that rather than the police coming and arresting him.
That's his own personal redemption. You know, his son shamed him into it. You know, he's like, you know, I do believe that a lot of racism is based in ignorance and, you know, a real lack of understanding or even interest in other, you know, cultures and other people. So in order for your son to be, you know, I mean, kids are pure.
Yeah.
You know, kids don't see color. They don't grow up with racist attitudes. They're pure. So I think when you grow up in an environment where people are racist, you either go two ways. You either take on their views or you rebel against it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was quite a powerful storyline.
Definitely.
And Spencer changed like that as well.
Yeah, that was great because, you know, Spencer was horrible when he was first in Grangehill. He really, really was. But that changes him later on as well. It changes so throughout the rest of the time he was on the programme. All that, his change all came back to that storyline. And then, so that was the end of Series 23. And then Tom was in the first episode of Series 24. Were you expecting to be in it? Because that's...
No, I don't think I was. Because, I mean, the assumption is that he hands himself in.
Yeah.
And he probably gets prison time.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really expecting to be in it. No, I think I might have been told that it was just for one season.
Yeah. So, because in the very first episode, Tom is there, and it's the night before he's going to court. And this is, I thought, although it must have been hard for Tom to do, you can see where he's changed, because he says to Spencer, "You're not coming to visit me if I go to prison, because I don't want you seeing me in there," basically. And then he was sent to prison for 2 years. And then we did, and then obviously that was the end of that storyline. And then you weren't in it again, but done so much since Grangehill. I mean, when I started looking at your CV, I thought I'm going to be here forever on this one. So I've just written down a few things. Now, obviously, a lot of the stuff you got into is sort of a lot of comedy acting.
Yeah.
Which do you prefer?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there wasn't much comedy in that storyline. Very little comedy at all. It was pure accident, to be honest with you, Neil. I got cast in The Office.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as Taffy, the warehouse manager.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, I then got the In-Betweeners.
Yeah.
Because Ricky knows Ian and Damien.
Right.
Damon, sorry, not Damon.
Yeah.
And so I think, I don't know if he put a word in for me or what, but they were certainly aware of what I'd done in The Office.
Right.
And that character, you know, Jay's dad is pretty similar to the character I played. Maybe the guy in The Office is a bit more horrible.
Well, that's it. The thing with The Office is, you were only, three episodes or something.
Yeah.
You were in.
I think it might have been five, actually.
Right. So when I saw it, I thought, is that all he was in? Because
the
character's so memorable. Because he is just horrible. I mean, to be honest, Taffy, Terry Cartwright, and Tom Hargreaves could all be related to three of them quite easily. Because they're all quite similar. Like,
someone said to me earlier on in my acting career, better to be typecast than not cast.
Definitely.
But, you know, since then, I've also gone to America and I've played an Eastern European vampire hunter.
Right.
I've played a British colonel, army colonel, from the Second World War called Colonel Gubbins, and I had to play him like that, you know. And what else have I done over there? I played a very posh ship's captain in Frontier. So I am actually, like most actors, extremely versatile. And you get the chance for versatility on stage, on TV. I'm either playing twatty dads or nasty swines. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess that's my casting range, and I'm not going to resist it.
No,
and
definitely.
I do as much drama as I do comedy. So in answer to your question, I like doing them both.
Yeah.
You know, I've just done a big, really serious film called Bermondsey Tales, where I played this, you know, quite psychotic gangster, you know. And then this morning, I won't say what the series is because I've had to sign an NDA, but I went up for this other character with a bit of light relief.
Right.
It involved cross-dressing.
Right, okay.
So I went up for that, and that involved And I was laughing my head off this morning doing the self-tape. So it's like, I love playing different people, you know. So it's like, I do seem to have, I mean, I never knew I had it until I did The Office and the In-Betweeners, but I do seem to have a natural instinct for comedy.
Yeah, because you were in 15 Stories High.
With Sean, dear old Sean Locke.
Now, I need to talk about that, because obviously that was Sean Locke did that. And everyone says that Sean Locke, like, even like comedy actors, comedians and everything, and like people, you know, like yourselves, you are naturally funny, but everyone says Sean Locke was just like the king of it. Like,
well, you know, I've been a little bit oblivious in my life. So I'm ashamed to say that when I did 15 Stories High, I had no idea who he was. I knew his name, but I didn't really know who he was. And Benedict Wong was also in that series. And I was playing this character, the caretaker. And, you know, they just did like this single shot from a distance. Uh-huh. It was like a long shot. And so we were all filmed at a distance. And I was playing this like caretaker of the block of flats. And he got me to smoke these bloody roll-ups. And he got me to smoke so many that I thought I was going to be sick.
Right.
I felt sick on the way home. And he was pushing me. He was trying to get me to do a performance that he wanted.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand. And I've got to be honest, by the end of the shoot, I wanted to say, Sean, can you just go forth and mock me? But even he saw the funny side of it at the end.
Yeah.
And he went, yeah, can you do a tap dance now, Dave? And we just laughed. And I gave him a hug. I said, great working with him, mate, but maybe don't direct me next time. But I look back on that little scene that I did sometimes and go, actually, that was quite good.
Yeah, yeah. And you've mentioned The Office and The In-Betweeners.
Mm.
And, you know, when you were filming them, did you have any idea of how big those two programmes were going to be?
Nope, no idea whatsoever.
No.
In fact, when I first did The Office, this will make you laugh, I auditioned for the part of Finchie.
Right.
Right? So I turn up. So then I go in and meet Ricky Gervais.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing I said to Ricky was, I said, I watched your chat show last night. You had Michael Winner on, didn't you?
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, yeah, I work with him. He's a complete twat, isn't he? and he laughed. And I swear that's what got me the job.
Right.
And then he said, and then on the day of filming, he said to me, you look like a proper geezer, so I'm going to put you in this warehouse scene. And he said, am I allowed to use rude words?
Yeah, go for it.
So in the scene, it's my dog shagging his dog.
Yeah.
And so I had, there was a line in the script that went, what she needs is a good shagging.
Yeah,
and he gave that to one of the supporting artists.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Ricky, that was my line. I said, do you know what you're doing, mate? And he went, no, probably not. I remember having a laugh, but also thinking, you can't give my line to an extra. It just shows what an idiot I was back then. And then a mate of mine pointed out, and he said, look at the way Ricky listens as an actor. Uh-huh. So you watch the scene, and he's like, and the way he reacts, he's brilliant. You know, that is all natural to him. And it wasn't until I got over the annoyance of not being cast as Finchie, and Ralph Ineson's such a great actor.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what I was like back in those days. And then I got cast in The In-Betweeners, and because I didn't get cast in the pilot, I was a bit like, well, I don't know what this thing's like. And then, you know, the first scene I did was the caravan scene inside the caravan. And I thought, these lads are weird. They don't gel. One of them's like a young Cockney who doesn't talk very much. That was James. The other two are Cambridge graduates. And then you got big, lanky Blake.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is never going to work. So I came out and I did my scene. And I knew that the scene was going to be funny. Because I was quite into my comedy stride by that point. Anyway, we then go and see the screenings of the first two episodes at Rich Mix in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
And as I'm watching it, I'm like, oh my God, this is really good.
Yeah.
I don't know, it just suddenly hit me that it was 1,000 times better than I had any conception of.
I mean,
and then I was right, you know. So I'm getting better at spotting what works, but I could never have guessed it was going to be the phenomenon that it became.
I mean, I remember watching that with one of my mates. He'd never seen it before, and he came round here and we put it on, and he was laughing his head off. But at one point he turned, he said, "I'm so angry." I said, "What are you angry about?" He said, "We should have written this. We could have written this." And I think that was the thing with the in between, is it was every kid's high school life, wasn't it?
Well, you try and be cool, but really, you always get bullied. You never get any sex, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I love Mr. Cartwright. Genuinely, besides the main four, he's probably my favourite character.
Can I just show you something? This won't translate to a podcast. But do you remember the In-Betweeners 10th anniversary?
Yeah,
that's what I won. Best parent. That is as good as getting an Oscar.
Yeah, David's just showed me his award for best parent from the In-Betweeners there. But the thing that really annoys me about those scenes that you're in, when you're taking the mick out of Jay, none of the other lads were laughing. And I could never understand that, because I just thought, if that was me and my mates, and one of their dads was saying that about his own son, we would have been killing ourselves, like rolling around on the floor. And it never made any sense to me like that. They never laughed, because every time Simon's dad said something, they all killed themselves laughing. But I don't know what it was, whether they were scared of Terry Cartwright, I don't know.
I think it's interesting, because I never really thought about that until now. I think it was because he was so abusive to Jay that they all kind of disapproved. But yeah, you would think, I mean, it's interesting that if I ever see any of them again, I'm going to say, why didn't you laugh? And I was thinking,
yeah, Jay. Okay, the stuff that he says to Jay, was that all scripted, or did you get to improvise any of that?
No, it was all scripted.
Right, okay.
I don't think I improvised a single thing. Right. Either in the office or in the In-Betweeners. It was all written. Okay. The one thing I will say is where I've been really lucky is that I did realize early on that the delivery of these lines was better in both instances, the office and the In-Betweeners, if I found them very funny.
Right.
Because like you've just said, when we used to take the piss out of each other at school, we would fall about laughing. And Taffy is like that. He finds everything he says hilarious. You know, everything's funny. And Terry's the same.
Yeah.
My dad used to do that a bit to me, not quite like Terry Cartwright.
No. Plus, my dad I don't think anyone's dad would do that.
Well, I don't know. A few kids I've met say they would. But, you know, if you find it really funny, the audience tend to. You know, it's a really strange thing.
Brilliant. And then obviously there was the two movies which you were in as well. The second one, set in Australia. Did you get to go to Australia, or was that filmed over here?
There's a funny story about that. So I was on holiday in Canada with my missus. And then I forgot that we were doing the In-Betweeners, or they hadn't given me the dates or whatever to fly out to Australia. So we were in Canada. They confirmed that I had to fly out a couple of days later. My wife and I, ex-wife now, we were due to go to New York after that. And it was absolutely bloody freezing, to be honest. It was like minus 12 when we got to Toronto. So part of me was relieved when I found out that I was flying to Sydney on New Year's Eve.
Right.
So I said to her, "I'm sorry." So she went off to New York on her own. Mind you, she managed to see Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz in that Broadway production of Betrayal while she was over there. So I was dead jealous about that. Anyway, so I'll get a flight to California, change the plane, and then get this all expenses paid business class flight to Sydney. Of course, New Year had come and gone by the time I arrived.
Yeah.
It was there like 12 hours ahead or whatever. And then I go to my hotel in Sydney, which was beautiful. And then I think I got flown to the Gold Coast straight after that. Can't remember how I got to the Gold Coast, actually. I just can't remember. Anyway, so then I'm in this hotel on the Gold Coast, overlooking the beach, thinking, wow, this is life. And then the next day I turn up to do the filming, and Ian, Morris says to me, "What are you doing here?" I said, "What do you mean, what am I doing here? You've put me in that big tracking scene, you know, in this house that Jay like lying about." You remember the very
the mansion?
It was a big tracking scene about him lying about living in this mansion. And I'm standing there with these three hipsters.
Yeah.
So Ian said, "Oh, we meant to write you out of that." None of the other adults got to go to Australia except me. And it was because they forgot to write me out of that scene. So I was like, yeah. And the money was much better than the first film.
Yeah.
So I had a touch in that film.
So is all the other bit at the end? Was that filmed in England, was it?
Bizarrely. Right. Yeah, the interiors were all filmed in England.
Right.
Except that one that was in Australia. So out of that, I managed to elongate my stay in Australia to 3 weeks.
Brilliant.
I flew my wife over. we did a big tour of like the Sydney area and went up, you know, the Blue Hills or whatever they're called, and the Three Sisters Mountains.
Oh, brilliant.
I mean, we had a great time.
Yeah.
And all on a mistake, that was.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Now, there was something I wanted to talk to you about. I saw a film on your IMDb, and it's called The 101-Year-Old Man Who Skipped Out on the Bill and Disappeared. And apparently you play this someone in the CIA, is that right?
American guy, yeah.
Right.
There's a lovely actor in that. Lovely actor whose name, this is going to be embarrassing. I nearly said Colin Salmon. It's not Colin Salmon, although I do know Colin Salmon. Colin McFarlane. Colin
right. McFarlane. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, wonderful actor. He's got a lovely deep voice. So what happened was I did a play in London. And the way that I got this play was that the two main actors had had an argument and they'd fallen out. They'd done it up north somewhere. I won't say who they are because I don't want to embarrass them. So one of the main actors dropped out and they were about to close the show. And I'd done a play in the West End called American Justice. Mm-hmm. So the director of this show reminded the other actor of me and said he did this brilliant performance in American Justice. Why don't you give him a ring? And the actor was saying, he's never going to do it. We've asked. Apparently, they went through the whole, you know, A list of actors that they knew. They also haven't got enough time. The show was going up in 12 days. So I read the play. It's called A Steady Rain, and it went on at the Arcola Theatre. So I read it, and it was written by the same guy that directed Mad Men.
Right.
That had written Mad Men.
Yeah.
And I was like, I've got to do this. This is amazing. So I agreed to do it. The first 3 days, I was working with a different director because the main actor and the other director couldn't be there.
Right.
So it was basically a line learning exercise.
Yeah.
But by the time the main actor turns up to rehearsals, I was, you know, getting used to what I was doing. They changed everything. Him and the real director changed the thing. So they just got me to slot in. Anyway, I was really struggling. So I had 12 days to learn 64 pages. I was really struggling. The dress rehearsal, I dried 6 times. Performance, I got through it. I chopped off a little bit, not much, about, you know, a couple of paragraphs. Yeah. We got through it. The actor was really happy. That night in the audience was a director from the National Theatre. I had an audition at the National the next day. And then the second evening, Barbara Broccoli, the producer of James Bond, turns up because she had produced it on Broadway with Daniel Craig and Hugh Jackman. So she comes backstage afterwards to say, well done, guys. And then the third night, Sarah Crowe, the casting director, turns up and cast me in that movie.
Wow.
That was the opening 3 nights of that play.
Wow, that's amazing. Because I just saw that title, I thought, there's no way a film's called that.
Yeah, it's based on a really popular book.
Yeah.
I think it's Swedish.
Yeah.
So we actually shot that in Budapest, that great scene that I'm in. Uh-huh. So get flown out to Budapest. The director was very, very good and very exacting about what he wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I felt a little bit intimidated by him, actually. I think he's a top Swedish director. So that was a great gig, and I became friends with Colin McFarlane.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a great job to do.
Yeah. And then you've done things like Ghosts and Doctors and
yeah.
stuff, but then you were all Power Tool Cheerleaders versus the boy band of the Screeching Dead. And I've only seen the trailer, but you're the first person in that trailer as well.
Yeah, again, it's another comedy part, really, but I then transform into a zombie, which is
Right.
fantastic. There's this brilliant scene where the actress Charlie Bond is basically murdering me with a power tool.
Right.
But because I was her boss and the only guy who was nice to her, she's crying as she murders me and blood splattering all over the place. But the director of that is a guy called Pat Higgins, who calls himself Pat King Higgins.
Right.
That's what it's called on IMDb Pro. It was a great gig that my old mucker James Hamer Morton was playing the lead, and him and Charlie produced it. So it was a great low budget film.
Brilliant. And you've also do some writing as well, and directing as well, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's, I've got a question here. When there's an episode of the podcast coming out, I put picture clues on social media, and the first person that guesses who it is gets to ask a question. Now, the question I've got is from someone. I've met this fella. He's called Steve Dutchboom. Okay, and his question is: he watched a short film that you had written and you were in called Poppy's Presents, and Chris Jory was in it. Chris Jory was also a teacher in Grange Hill.
He was
back in the day, Mr. Knowles.
Have you had him on this podcast?
He's been on, yeah. He's brilliant, Chris. Yeah, he's
one of my best friends.
I was going to say you've done. When I was looking, you were in quite a few things with Chris.
Yeah, I spoke to him the day before yesterday. I forgot to mention this, but I'm going down to visit him soon.
All
he's got a caravan down in Bridgeport.
So yeah, so he said the story was it's reminiscent of a Velvet Underground track,
yeah,
called The Gift. So when you've written that film, were you aware of the
John Cale song, isn't it?
Yeah.
About Marsha and Waldo. So what happened was I've got a friend called Corin Mellinger, and the original idea was his. And at the time we were hanging out, I think I was doing a play with him, and we were hanging out, and he said that he'd started to write a script around this story based on The Gift, about this guy who sends himself to his girlfriend who's at university, and she goes to open the box with a pair of shears and accidentally kills him. And I thought, what a great story. What a great idea, you know, sort of Tales of the Unexpected type idea for a short film. So I was quite pushy in those days. I went, I'll co-write it with you. He was like, oh, all right. So we co-write it. I'd just done a film called The Big Game with Chris. So he was going on about having his own production company called Picture This, I think they were called. And I gave him the script and he went, yeah, I really like it. I'll direct it. So I think he raised a bit of money and he directed it and we made it. Yeah. So it was a really good experience. It's a lot of fun doing that, you know.
Is that what sort of led you in then to doing the writing? And
yeah, yeah. And then from then on, I carried on writing. So, you know, I wrote a couple of film scripts. I wrote a couple of plays, which I took up to Edinburgh. One was called Reality Chokes, which Chris directed. And then I did another one called Brotherly Love, which I was in. And we took up to Edinburgh as well. Bob Wolstenholme was the director of that one.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, and I've written a couple of movies, one of which I'm supposed to be co-directing, called Back to Archway.
Uh-huh.
As we speak, I'm still waiting for the money to go through. It's a 350 grand film.
Right, wow.
And I'm co-directing it with Frank Harper.
Uh-huh. You know, so when you are writing, and you're writing stuff like that, do you think, I'm having that part because I've written this?
Yeah, of course. Why, you know, I'm an actor first and foremost.
Yeah.
If I'm going to write, why would I not write myself into it? You know, writing's like giving birth. I've written this other film called Heavenly Waters, and I've written a part for me in that as well. I've co-written that with a friend of mine called Kim Leggett. And, you know, and for every script, you have to do about 5, 6, 7 drafts.
Uh-huh.
And you're not going to go through all that and not give yourself a decent part.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. Right. Now, the other thing as well, David, is that you also, I've got this right, that you teach acting as well.
Yeah, because when I did that teaching course I uh-huh. spoke about earlier on, one of my teaching placements was at East Berkshire Further Education College. Right. And one of the people there was a guy called Nick Mosley. And he was such a great drama teacher. I said to him, you're wasted in this school, this college. You should be teaching at drama school. So subsequently, he then got a job at Italia Conti on the adults course. He ran that. And then he became the head of acting at Central.
Right.
So while he was there, he got me into Central. I ended up teaching Roman Polanski's daughter on TV technique.
Uh-huh.
So whenever I see her, I go, I taught her everything she knows. But then I sat on the auditioning panel at Central for years.
Right.
And now I teach at another place called The Real Scene, R-E-E-L.
Right.
And they've got people like Kevin McNally. They have a lot of really good people who are in the industry. So they got me, Steve North, Frank Harper does it as well. So, you know, they have a lot of people who are working professionals.
Yeah.
Lydia, who was in the Inbetweeners movies,
teaches
there as well.
Brilliant. Yeah. Okay, well, we are coming towards the end. Now, before I get to my final questions, we have talked a bit about The Office and The Inbetweeners. Which one do you get recognised from the most?
Oh, definitely The Inbetweeners.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, people who watch The Office are sort of my age and maybe 10 years younger than me, but The Inbetweeners is more recent.
Yeah.
And I think The Inbetweeners gets repeated, seems to me, continuously on Channel 4.
And what do you get shouted at you the most?
People don't tend to shout at me.
Okay.
I think they're all a bit scared of me. But the line that they always want me to repeat is, he's got a cock like a McDonald's chip.
Do you know what? That was the only one I could think of.
Well, the other one that I often quote is, women are like fairground rides, f***ing mental.
Yeah, do you know what? Brilliant.
That's the other one.
Brilliant.
There's a few, you know, calling a dog a shitting machine. And, and it's meant to be work experience, not standing around being a useless tosser experience or useless twat experience.
With your qualifications, you'll be lucky to get a job throwing shit into a skip. That's the one I like as well. Brilliant. All right, then. Excellent. Okay. And do you ever get recognised for being in Grange Hill?
Actually, believe it or not, yes.
Right.
So, you know, I told you I was born in America.
Uh-huh.
Well, I went to the American embassy one day to renew my American passport.
Right.
And they're actually quite quick in there. You just get your photo taken at, you know, this photographer's place down the road, and then you have to get through security to get there. Pretty hot in security. So you go in there, you queue up, they, get the passport together. I think you have to wait, and then they deliver it to you, stamp it, blah, blah, blah. So just as I was leaving, these two security guards pull me over and go, can we have a word with you? They were British.
Yeah.
So the first thing I thought was, what are two Brits doing working American embassy security guard? But I didn't question them. So until I heard them speak, I thought they were like from the CIA or something.
Yeah.
So they called me in this room and they said to me, we need to ask you a question. I hope you don't mind. I was like, oh my God.
Oh, no.
And I said, what? And they said, did you play Tom Hargreaves in Grange Hill? I said, you're joking. And this was about 10 years after I'd done it.
No way.
I said, you guys remember that? They went, yeah, you were fantastic. It's such a good storyline. You were part of our childhood.
Brilliant.
So I think that may be the one and only time I've ever got recognised from Grange.
Oh, brilliant. So, as like I say, we are coming to the end, and I have the same questions that I ask everyone. So even though you weren't in Grange Hill for very long, you're not getting away with it.
I was in it for a year, by the way.
So recently, there's been talk of a Grange Hill movie in the pipeline. Phil Redmond is writing it. Sarah Sugarman, who was a pupil in Grange Hill, she played Jessica Samuels, is directing it. What do you think of the idea of a Grange Hill movie?
I think it's a fantastic idea. I mean, Grange Hill was one of these seminal programs on when I was a kid. It covered lots of issues, you know, and I remember a lot of those characters being iconic. You know, as I said before, Todd Carty and Susan Tully went on to be in EastEnders. So it was part of my childhood. I would love to see a Grange Hill film.
Brilliant. And if you were asked, would we see a return of Tom Hargreaves?
Yeah. I think it might be a bit of a controversial storyline. Let's hope he's been rehabilitated.
Yeah, let's hope so, yeah.
Since he's been in prison, you know?
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, of course I would.
Brilliant. And so then, other than Tom Hargreaves, who was your favourite character in Grange Hill?
Well, it's got to be Tucker, isn't it? Yeah. That's the one. Tucker and Gripper, I think. Just because they were the two that I remember the most clearly. And all the kids at school said Tucker was such a cool dude. You know, so those are the ones that I remember the best.
Brilliant. And so if you couldn't have played Mr. Hargreaves, would you like to have played one of those other two characters then?
Yeah, I would have been a really good bully. I've never been a cool kid.
You surprised me there with that one.
Yeah, I was always the kid who got bullied at school because I was moving from one school to another. But the reason why I'm so good at playing bullies is because I remember how I got bullied. Yeah. The psychology of bullying is, you know, it's etched on my brain for all time.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, then so then the final question, David, is why do you think there's still such affection for Grange Hill?
Because I think it's a fantastic program that looks at it from the teacher's point of view as well as from the kids' point of view. I think it was one of the few programs on, you know, few soaps actually that offers hope. You know, I like the fact that a lot of the storylines end up with a sort of happier ending. You know, in soaps is always doom and destruction. I felt there was an innocence about Grange Hill which reflected childhood. And it's like the issues that were dealt with, they always had really satisfying denouements. So that's what I remember from Grange Hill. You know, the bullies always got their comeuppance in the end as well.
Yeah.
Doesn't always happen in real life, but I think in Grange Hill land, they always got their comeuppance.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on. I know you're a busy man. People are listening. We had to put this interview when we recorded it, and we've had to put it back because
I was dressing as a woman this morning.
Like I say, thanks so much for coming on, giving us your take, not only on your time on Grange Hill, on the industry as a whole as well. It's been really interesting listening to you and hearing your side of things there. So once again, thanks very much for coming on.
Absolute pleasure, Neil. Thanks very much.
Not a problem.
Mate.
And for anyone that's listening, I'll speak to you next time. Cheers. All thanks. Right, bye-bye.